Welcome to the August 15th, 2009 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you over the air by WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, Illinois, and webcast worldwide at WEFT.org. The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WFT, its board of directors, associates, station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated. Okay, we're going to be having a two-hour show today, and Roger Silverman from London, England, is going to be calling in, and we're going to be having, it's going to be a little something a little different. We're going to be having one guest and basically a whole bunch of people interview him, including John Ryman from Oakland, California, who's also going to be on the phone with Roger. Roger happens to be out in Oakland right now visiting John Ryman, so that'll help. And also we got the usual Labor Hour Cultural Corner and some news. And anyway, Tom will have some, also his poem for today is called Beyond Burning Oil. And here today also is Bob Pelesny, our technical expert and advisor, who has some news and banner for us, and special co-host Damian Matthew. And anyway, on with the show.
The Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the Illinois Education Association Teachers Union and the Central Illinois Jobs with Justice. Building coalitions amongst workers, unions, and the community, the Illinois Education Association and the Central Illinois Jobs with Justice are proud to support WEFT Community Radio in East Central Illinois. This hour of programming is also brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of Maintenance Way. The Brotherhood of Maintenance Way employees are proud to to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour, a democratic union. BMWE celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that they enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. The Illinois World Labor Hour is also supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Okay, well, thank you, Tom. And also, I want to mention that Jermaine Light of the Illinois Education Association Teachers Union is going to be also joining us on the second portion of the two-hour program today. And I guess this will be the last two-hour show we're going to be doing along with Donnie D. We've been alternating every other week. Turns out that there's a person who's going to be doing the 12 to 1 time slot. They got a new program coming your way. So, well, anyway, now we'll have a little workers' news. Tom?
Employers who have cut jobs over the past year are in no hurry to start hiring again just because the recession appears to be tapering off. From a North Carolina machine maker to an Oregon heating and cooling company, small business owners are saying they are going to need to see several months of rising sales before they can start adding to their staffs. Because labor is the biggest expense for most companies, that extent of caution is typical at the end of recessions. After the last one the government owns up to in 2001, unemployment kept rising and didn't peak until June of 2003, 19 months into the so-called economic recovery. This time around, economists are saying the employment rate will probably not return to healthy levels until the year 2013 because companies have been slashing workers' hours, squeezing more work out of the employees who are left, and relying on cheaper temporary staffers to fill the gaps. Employers wiped out 247,000 jobs in July alone, but it still is far fewer than any other month of this year. The economy shrank in the second quarter at a much slower pace, and businesses are seeing real results of a warming economy. However, unfortunately, that is not translating into much needed job creation.
Okay, Tom, I've got a story here too. This is originally out of U.S. News and World Report. When it comes to hiring, some employers act like they hold all the cards and they can treat job seekers as poorly as they want without consequence. They're wrong. Smart employers know that good candidates have options. Here are five common ways employers behave badly when hiring. Having no regard for the candidate's time, from last-minute cancellations without apology or acknowledgement of the inconvenience to not paying attention in the interview, some employers act like their time is the only time that matters. Not sharing their timeline. Sometimes employers have some idea of whether they'll be getting back to candidates in a week or a month. There's no reason for them not to share that information, and it can be agonizing on the job seeker side to have no sense of the timeline the employer will be moving on. Also, refusing to share their salary range but asking you for yours. Employers know roughly how much they're willing to pay. There's no reason not to share that info other than that they're hoping to get you for a lower price. But that's lame. Misrepresenting the work. Sometimes interviewers who make the job sound more glamorous or downplay less attractive aspects of the job, such as long hours, they're guaranteeing they'll end up with a bitter employee. And lastly, not notifying candidates that they're no longer under consideration. This is both common and inexcusably rude. Dave?
Okay, the 77-day strike at the Sungyeon Motor Company in Pyeongtaek, South Korea, that we've reported on a couple times last several episodes, ended on Wednesday, August 5th, in total defeat for the 975 workers who occupied the plant on May 22nd, fighting layoffs and forced early retirement. In the course of the occupation, the Korean government and the company cut off water, gas, and finally electricity and prevented food and water deliveries to the occupation. Nevertheless, strikers fought off repeated assaults, sometimes involving up to 3,000 police, hired thugs, and scabs. In the final days, police helicopters hovered over the plant 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, blaring noise that made sleep impossible and dropping tear gas laced with toxic material on workers with no water to wash it off. After the final capture, the last building held by the strikers, a settlement was reached with 52% of workers being retained for a 1-year furlough without pay and 48% definitively fired. But since August 5th, the Korean government and the company have relentlessly pressed their advantage. The government is bringing major legal charges against at least 66 strikers and fining the union a huge sum. Korean law also makes it possible to sue individual workers for damages incurred during a strike, which in the past has left workers destitute, and such lawsuits are probably in the offing. This is not just to defeat the strike. This is an attempt by the hard-right South Korean government of Lee Myung-bak to terrorize any future serious opposition to its crisis policies.
Scraps of food left over from Purdue University's dining courts could soon be converted into inexpensive energy for the city of West Lafayette, Indiana. The city is negotiating with Purdue to take food waste from the university and convert it into methane gas at the area's wastewater treatment plant. The methane would be used to generate electricity to help run the plant, hopefully reducing consumers' energy bills. Purdue University officials say the university serves more than 3.25 million meals a year, and that produces about 20 tons of food waste per month. Currently, the university pays to have that waste hauled to landfill. The university is also finding a new use for the dining court's leftover grease. Recent news releases indicate that biofuel consultants will be buying the grease and turning it into biodiesel fuel. Bob?
Okay, yesterday, August 14th, was an anniversary of sorts. Back in 1980, on August 14th, it was the beginning of an occupational strike in the linen shipyard of Gdansk. Lech Walesa became the leader of this strike, and the strike was spontaneously followed by similar strikes, first in Gdansk and then across Poland. And by September of that year, the communist government signed an agreement with the Strike Coordination Committee to allow legal organization but not actual free trade unions. The Strike Coordination Committee legalized itself into the National Coordinating Committee of Solidarity, the Free Trade Union, and Lech Walesa was chosen as the chairman of this committee.
Well, great story, Bob. Yeah. You know, the really sad thing, you can read an account in Naomi Klein's book, Shock Doctrine, about how the Solidarity Union movement in Poland was betrayed after the fall of the Soviet Union. I mean, basically, they went from the the totalitarian communist system that was imposed in Eastern Europe to free market capitalism. And a lot of people wondered if it wasn't better off a lot of ways under the totalitarian Stalinist governments of Poland at that time. It's a really sad story. But anyway, this is some interesting information here. The International Monetary Fund puts total cost of the financial crisis currently at $11.9 trillion. That's enough to finance a handout for of about $2,500 for every man, woman, and child on the planet. Which could go a long ways in some third world countries. The staggering total is equivalent to around a fifth of the entire globe's annual economic output and includes capital injections pumped into banks in order to prevent them from collapse, the cost of soaking up so-called toxic assets, guarantees over debt and liquidity support from central banks. Although much of the total may never be called on, the potential outlay will still dwarf any previous repair bill for the global economy. The IMF calculations produced ahead of the two-year anniversary of the crisis underline the continuing mounting costs. Most of the cash has been handed out by developed countries, for whom the bill has been $10.2 trillion, while developing countries have spent only about $1.7 trillion, the majority of which is in central bank liquidity support for their stuttering financial sectors. What's interesting, too, is that after the last recession back in the 90s, the productivity of the U.S. economy increased 19% from 2000 to 2007, but the real median income of working households fell $2,000 in real terms. Growth, this basically, what happened there is that growth at the top of the income scale, but actually a decline in the middle and lower income scales. So let's see if, I got a funny feeling this is, we're going to have probably another round of that here in this so-called new recovery, and I'll bet you it's going to be even worse.
Thanks to federal stimulus funding, a handful of area school districts are going to be making some much-needed improvements to their cafeterias before the start of the school year. The Urbana School District will receive $43,909 to replace outdated equipment at the Prairie Elementary School. The Westville School District will get $13,062. Jamaica got $11,260. Hoopston got $11,115. And Rossville got $3,450. The Illinois State Board of Education heard some $34 million in grant requests, but was only able to distribute about $3.6 million to 254 schools in 84 school districts across the state. The money is intended to help the schools increase energy efficiency and improve food safety and the quality of meals, and to boost participation in the school's meal program. Schools participating in the National School Lunch Program are eligible to apply for the federal funds, but priority was given to districts in which 50% or more of the student population is eligible for free or reduced price meals. Bob?
Yeah, here I've got a story from the UK. Unison, the UK's largest public sector union, is sending an NHS fact file to its sister unions in the States to counter the lies being peddled by right-wing groups about the NHS. Dave Prentice, General Secretary of Unison, said, "I, like so many other people in the UK, owe my life to the NHS. We are outraged by the gross lies and distortions being spread in the U.S. about our NHS. A universal health system that is free at the point of need is something that we can all be proud of. It is a mark of our civilized, caring society. People love the NHS in this country because it is always there for them when they need it. Regardless of your income, the NHS provides peace of mind, even at the most uncertain economic times like those we're experiencing now. In the U.S., losing your job means losing your health insurance." And Unison is sending its fact file to our sisters' unions in the States to give them the ammunition to fire at the NHS detractors. They will see for themselves the truth about how our NHS operates and how patients are treated.
And, of course, the NHS stands for National Health Service.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, Michael Moore's film, Sicko, I think, showed a little example of the healthcare system in England, as well as France and Canada. And speaking of healthcare, I got some more information on some things.
The way that movie opened made a big statement with a guy sewing up his own arm because he couldn't afford to go to the hospital.
Oh, yeah, and they said he's one of 25% of people in this country that don't have health insurance. Well, this movie's not about them. It's about those who do have health insurance, who are denied care and everything
else. Pre-existing conditions and stuff.
Yes, exactly. So, okay, we'll go to a little bit of worker independent news.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. This week, AFL-CIO Secretary-Treasurer Richard Trumka headed to the Steelworkers Convention in Nevada to accept the union endorsing his bid to be the next AFL-CIO president. During his acceptance speech, Trumka called candidates that received labor support during the election to the mat, vowing that there would be repercussions if those politicians backed off promises made to earn organized labor's trust.
"And if you stab us in the back on the Employee Free Choice Act and health care and a bunch of other things, don't you dare. Don't you dare ask for our support next year whenever you're running. We need people who stand up for workers."
The International Association of Machinists is asking the National Mediation Board to recognize Delta and Northwest Airlines as a single operating unit. If it does, the union will then need to prove that 35% of workers want a union, and that will lead to a vote where the IAM will need to win a majority vote from workers on whether or not to continue having union representation. The IAM represents workers at Northwest, but workers in similar duties at Delta are currently non-union. Also seeking such a ruling from the board is the Association of Flight Attendants. If the board agrees, both unions could see elections as early as this fall. A clothing factory in Long Island City is being charged with operating as a sweatshop by workers. According to the New York Daily News, workers for Great Wall Corporation have been rallying outside of the factory and allege that they were fired after they complained to management about work weeks as long as 100 hours and wages below the minimum. Some employees were allegedly forced to work more than 15 hours, and the company would lock doors until garment orders were completed. The fired workers are filing a complaint with the National Labor Relations Board. This isn't the first time Great Wall has been accused of wage violations. Bankruptcy filings jumped 35% between the end of June last year and the end of June this year. 1.3 million bankruptcies were filed in the United States over the 12-month period, with 55,000 of those bankruptcies being business bankruptcies. Chapter 11 bankruptcies were up by 91%. Those types are used to reorganize businesses. General Motors and Chrysler were the most well-known filers for such bankruptcy protection in the last year. Chapter 7 filings were up by 47%. Under Chapter 7, debtors are required to sell property.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Okay, now we come to that portion of our program, the Cultural Corner, with Tom Thomas's poem this week, Beyond Burning Oil.
Some say that the earth is warming, while others are saying it's not. But temperatures are turning, and everywhere it's getting more hot. Nature's warnings now are countless, and everyone we should heed. We must abuse our earth much less in satisfying human need. Let's keep what's left of our ozone. Stop burning our forests away. Save our cities before they're gone, either burnt or flooded away. Let's change the old technologies that are melting our polar caps. Wind can bring electricity with blades on each mill turning laps. Rushing waters can generate power to give each city light. To save mankind is not too late, but first we have to win a fight. Society now needs to force the oil giants to step down. Before they make our world much worse, each titan needs to lose his crown. We, the people of this world, who want this world to live on, need to march with flags unfurled till all our oppressors are gone. Beyond Burning Oil was written at the Poets Loft in Champaign, Illinois on August 12, 2009. And was first recited live August 15th, 2009, and on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. I've got one public service announcement here. Among the international guests invited to attend the AFL-CIO National Convention in Pittsburgh, September 13th to 17th, will be the Iraqi union leaders. They'll appear at events organized by United Steelworkers, or actually U.S. Law. Anyway, and it's affiliates in Washington, D.C., New York City, and Philadelphia. One of their appearances at 1199 SEIU United Healthcare Workers East in New York City will also be simulcast by closed-circuit television to 1,199 facilities in Buffalo, Syracuse, Boston, Rochester, Buffalo, Baltimore, and possibly elsewhere. But anyway, the Iraqi trade unionists, their tentative schedule, besides the AFL-CIO convention in Pittsburgh, will be September the 8th through the 12th, Washington, D.C., September 13th to 16th, Pittsburgh, the AFL-CIO convention, September 17th to 20th, New York City, September 21st to 22nd, Philadelphia, and September 23rd, they'll depart back for Iraq. And so anyway, if you get a chance, unfortunately it's all on the East Coast, but anyway, I'm just glad to see that AFL-CIO is inviting them to here to talk about conditions in Iraq. And also Marty Connolly, who was on the air several weeks ago, was talking about Sama Television, the independent Iraqi television and video production. They had a benefit for him, I guess, last night in Chicago at the United Electrical Workers Union Hall, and hopefully it went well. Marty's listening. Maybe if you want to give us a little update on that, how it went, and Marty's promised to get some of their video footage for us and stuff, and if he does come through with that, which I'm sure he will, then we're going to definitely be showing that on Labor's View Television on Comcast Channel 6, Urbana Public Television, which is new. The new show for the new season will be starting will be aired on Sunday of Labor Day weekend. Okay, well, pretty soon our guest will be calling in. So first, I'm going to play a little music that he requested, and this is from Billie Holiday, "Gloomy Sunday."
Numberless little white flowers will never waken you. Not where the black coach of sorrow has taken you. Angels have no thought of ever returning you. Would they be angry if I thought of joining you? Gloomy Sunday, gloomy Sunday, with shadows I spend it all. My heart and I have decided to end it all. Soon there'll be candles and prayers that are said, I know. Let them not weep, let them know that I'm glad to go. Death is no dream, for in death I'm caressing you. With the last breath of my soul, I'll be blessing you. Gloomy Sunday, dreaming, and I find you asleep in the deep of my heart, dear. Darling, I hope that my dream never haunted you. My heart is telling you how much I wanted you.
Hello, you're on the air live.
Hello.
Yes, is this Roger?
Yeah, it is.
Roger, welcome to the Illinois World Labor Hour. I have Roger Silverman on the line here, and Roger, why don't you tell us a little about yourself?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say how glad I am to be here. I've had a real warm welcome from my friends and comrades in America. Where do you want to start?
Well, okay. First of all, what do you do for a living? Kind of, what your job is, and I don't know, just a little bit of, just a real rough, short background about yourself, and then I do have some questions for you, specific questions.
Okay. Well, at the moment, I'm working as a teacher in a secondary school in England. I'm a teacher of English. I'm a political activist. I spent 20 years as a full-timer working for my political ideas for the labor movement internationally. I think that's quite a good start.
Okay, yes, indeed. And you teach I've heard a lot of the students in your class are actually, at least their families, are from other countries around the world other than
we have
UK.
I work in a working-class school at the East End of London,
mm-hmm.
and it's a completely multi-ethnic community. The majority are Muslims from Bangladesh, but there are also people from all over the Indian subcontinent, from the Caribbean, from Africa, from Eastern Europe, from Latin America, even a few from England.
Okay, and speaking of the Indian subcontinent, I understand that back in the 1980s that you actually lived and did some worker and community organizing in India. Could you tell us a little about that?
Yes, I did that. I was privileged, actually, to... When I was working for the socialist cause, I was privileged to be traveling all over the world, and a large part of that time happened to be in the Indian subcontinent. I was based in India, and I traveled around in India, in Pakistan, in Sri Lanka, and elsewhere in Asia. I would say I learned enormously from the courage, the heroism, the self-sacrifice of workers in that part of the world. You know, I witnessed many quite world-shaking events, coups, civil wars, riots, and massive and tremendous general strikes and events of that nature. And I'll tell you one thing, that, you know, I considered myself a sort of activist for the labor movement, but I've never seen such courage and heroism as I've seen from some of those workers. People on the front lines, on the strike picket lines and so on, they literally quite casually and quite easily took their lives in their hands. So there were many events of a quite horrific nature that are not known in the West, not known internationally, but where the bodies of strikers were found floating down the river and piling up in the ditches. And these workers were quite content to take their lives in their hands in order to fight for a cause and to fight for their rights.
You know, I never heard about that, that there was such violence in India, you know, related to labor movement and stuff, that they're actually, know, labor people murdered and stuff. I mean, that's incredible.
Oh, I could tell you so many stories about that, yeah.
Okay. Now, I understand that there was, during the 1980s, that there were some communal riots that happened. And was this during the time you were there, or was that...
yes, it was, absolutely. I'm afraid I witnessed some terrible events. I saw... You know, when Indira Gandhi was assassinated in the mid-1980s, I was in Delhi at the time, and there was a complete massacre of Sikhs. Something like 3,000 Sikhs were killed. The Sikhs made up quite a big part of the population of Delhi.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they're very easily identifiable. Later on, at the time of the riots over the temple in the north, if you remember that. So I was in Mumbai when there was an example of what you could only call ethnic cleansing, where there was a complete communal bloodbath, you know, where Muslims in the slums were being targeted by a party called Shiv Sena, which consciously modelled itself on Hitler and the Nazis and said that the Muslims were the Jews of India. And the slums were set on fire. Children running out of the slums were thrown back into the flames. People were raped. People were chopped up with machetes. These communal events, these took place in inverse proportion, you could say, to the movement to the strike movement of the workers. I would say that communal politics came to the fore in India after the defeat of a massive strike, the textile strike in Mumbai, where something like 100,000 workers were involved. No, 200,000 or 300,000, I think, workers were involved. It lasted about a year. And that was the culmination of a period of great upsurges, great upheavals, huge rise in trade unionism, in strikes, and so on. And when that was defeated, that was the time for the communal insects to crawl out of the woodwork. And I'm afraid since then, Indian politics and the politics of the whole region have been, to a large extent, communal rather than class politics.
You know, that's amazing because, you know, myself and I imagine most people are quite familiar with what happened after the British were forced to leave India in, I guess it was 47 or whenever, and then India was divided into India and West Pakistan, East Pakistan, but I had no idea that these sort of things on that scale had occurred.
It's interesting you mention that because everybody knows about the communal divisions in India in 1947 and the split of India into communal units. But what's not so well known is that there was an enormous, at the time of the real upsurge of the nationalist movement, there was really hardly a trace of communalism. But in 1946, the whole subcontinent was more or less paralyzed by mutinies of the army, of the sailors, of the police, by general strikes, by local uprisings, and so on. And this was in support of three defendants who were put on trial by the British for their alleged lack of patriotism to the British Empire during the war.
There was actual...
They formed the Indian National Army. And these three people who were on trial were actually respectively a Hindu,
a Muslim, and a Sikh. And the whole of the population turned out in their support. And it was because India became completely ungovernable that the British had to hurriedly withdraw. But they left a little poisonous little serpent behind them in the form of the communal virus. And they made sure that when they left behind them a divided subcontinent and all the horrors of the wars and the upheavals that have happened since then.
You know, this seems to be a common theme with imperialism, it seems like, throughout the history. I mean, what you
look around the world.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And most of the problems in the world today are a little parting present from British imperialism in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you look at Ireland,
mm-hmm.
You look at the Middle East, you look at the Indian subcontinent, and many other examples too. It's the British were past masters at divide and rule.
Okay. Yeah, also, you know, of course, we see this happening in Iraq, or did, you know.
Absolutely.
You know, just a few years ago and stuff. Okay, so let's fast forward to, let's say, today, or roughly the current period. You know, the media portrays India as this rapidly modernizing country, also there's all sorts of, we all know, investment of international capital in India been going on for a while now. What do you think is going to be the eventual outcome of this? I mean, is India ever going to become a modern capitalist society? You know, how will this affect the working class in India?
Well, to an extent, certainly. I mean, it's a remarkable thing. We've got an entirely changed physiognomy of the world working class now. You mentioned about India. If you take India and China and the other parts of the world that were formerly not regarded as centers of proletarian industry, of course, things have changed entirely. In fact, I was seeing a figure that nowadays, for every one worker in the West, in what was traditionally called the West, Western Europe, North America, and you could include Japan. But for every one worker in those regions, there are now five proletarian workers in China, India, Russia, Latin America, Southeast Asia, etc. And in fact, the working class, for the first time, represents a majority of the world population. There are 3 billion wage workers in the world today. When you come to India, of course, that's right. There's a big development in particular sectors. Whether India can become a fully rounded out industrial economy, I think, is very, very dubious. Because
mm-hmm.
in a way, what's happening is, in the way that British imperialism in the past used to let the Indians cook their food for them and wash their clothes for them and do menial jobs like this, if you look at their role in the world economy today, it's a bit as if the Indians now are being enlisted to type their letters for them, to design their spreadsheets and so on. In other words, it's quite a narrow job description. The division of labor is that in India, that's where the computer software is designed.
Yes.
So I'm not sure whether it can develop in the same way that China is developing as mm-hmm. a truly industrial society.
Okay.
But of course, to an extent, that is happening.
Okay. I don't know about Europe, but I know here in the United States, when you have any kind of PC problem or, you know, if you have a problem with your cell phone or whatever, it seems like, you know, you call the call center, you know, the support, and it's, you know, always, it seems like every country, every corporation in this country is offshored that service support to India. And I was just wondering if that was the case in Europe as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yes, mm-hmm. yes. In a way, you know, they answer the phone for us now, whereas they used to do those other menial jobs. Mm-hmm. The call centers are in India. Of course, India has one big advantage in that, in the sort of a large English-speaking, educated population,
mm-hmm.
unfortunately still willing to work for very low wages.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the reason for the prevalence of call centers.
Okay. And we're going to take a real short musical break here, and then we come back. I would like to talk a little about Britain. Roger, just stay on the line, and listeners, we'll be right back with Roger Silverman.
Thank you.
Noble Lord, fortune built on sweat and soil. Built an empire tall as a hill, but he don't have fun and he never will. My, 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 my. Sees the world so far below, and though he tries, he'll never know. Friends to greet the breaking day, and love to pass the night away. My, my. William Francis High and Dry, with his paradise denied.
Okay, that was Chumbawamba, William Francis, a song about a capitalist that just isn't very happy despite all of his money. Roger, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Great. Oh, yeah, excellent. Okay. Okay, I'd like to talk a little about Britain now, and well, I guess there's a lot to talk about, of course, but the British workers' movement, you know, it's been a long tradition through the Labour Party. Unlike the Democratic Party in the United States, the Labour Party was actually a grassroots worker-form party that eventually became a, I guess you could call a mainstream party. What happened to the Labour Party? I mean, you know, it's like it seems like it was totally co-opted sometime, you know, back in the 90s or whatever by the capitalist class, and it's no longer a workers' party.
Well, that's you put your finger on it, David. I mean, I'm afraid that seems to be what's happening. Of course, that's still a matter of big controversy among workers and socialists in Britain. Mm-hmm. But you're quite right. The Labour Party was founded originally as a party of the working class, as its name implies. And in 1918, I would say under the direct impact of the Russian Revolution, it adopted a socialist clause calling for, the in effect, the public ownership of the economy. You would say that there was a long, long residual loyalty of workers to the Labour Party, particularly as a result of the experience of the Labour government which came to power, swept to power, at the end of the Second World War. That 1945 government enacted at a time when capitalism was, of course, completely shattered in a completely derelict state as a result of the war, and where capitalism was largely discredited and had very little power of resistance. And the Labour government, though it didn't carry through a full socialist revolution by any means, which was one of the great lost opportunities of history, but it did carry through nationalisation of basic industries, of coal, of steel, of the railways, of gas, electricity, of telecommunications, and so on. And it did, in particular, carry through a very a reform that is very dear still to the heart of the British working class, which was the National Health Service, which is, of course, something accepted in most properly civilised countries and taken for granted nowadays. In the period since then, there were Labour governments at times of crisis of capitalism that came in the 1960s and the 1970s, although they didn't carry through anything like the same scale of reforms. The capitalists resented their usurpation of office, and there were measures of strong resistance by the capitalists, and they were there, obviously, only there when the capitalists were unable to rule through their own organizations or their own parties. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, as you put it very well yourself, David, something happened to the Labour Party. In the 1990s, there was a takeover. There was a coup, if you like, was carried through. New Labour was established, which even by name has proclaimed itself to be a new party and a new tradition, a different tradition from that of Labour.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a trick, really. It was a device by the capitalists to carry forward the Thatcherite counter-revolution at a time when the Conservatives had become so completely discredited by corruption that they were unable to carry it through themselves. And for a long time, you know, Blair and Brown were able to carry through and even to take the counter-revolution of Thatcher on to levels that even she had not dared to attempt. For instance, nationalisation of air traffic, privatisation of air traffic control, the introduction of fees for higher education, and similar measures like this. But I think now New Labour has completely discredited itself, particularly with the crisis in the economy that has developed worldwide, and it's outlived its usefulness for the capitalists. So I think that's the reason why you're seeing a collapse of support for Brown mm-hmm. and the current Labour government, New Labour government, which hasn't got the support either of the workers nor of the capitalists, because it's not really able to fulfil properly the interests of either in the best way. And therefore, it seems likely that there'd be a big crisis, a big defeat for Labour, and a return of the traditional party of big business in Britain, the Conservatives.
Well, you know, I'm wondering how this happened. I mean, the thing is, here in the United States, our political system, our parties, are all financed by corporate campaign contributions. So it's and not to mention the fact that the Democratic Party never was, when it originally was formed, was not a working class party. Even though, you know, a lot of people are under the illusions that it is, mainly because of the New Deal under FDR during the 1930s and everything else. But you know, it's no wonder why our political system, our political parties, their major political parties, are in such a non-representative of the average worker, because of the campaign corporate campaign contributions that funds their television ads, their radio ads, and everything. If they can't get on, a politician or a party can't get its message to the airwaves, then no one knows they even exist. So I'm just wondering. I know there's like public campaigns in Britain, and that that, you know, this is not the way things are done there. How did they do this then, if they weren't able to bribe their way like they do here in the United States?
Well, that's interesting too. You know, during the peak of New Labour, they were getting more donations from big business than the Tories were. In fact, the Tories were for several years they were unable to collect any sizable donations or funds. They were reduced to, I think, one crook who was based in Belize, all places.
Okay,
but
so
he was the one who was financing the Tory party for a long time.
So in Britain, you have campaign contributions. I wasn't aware of that. I'm more familiar with the continent, with Germany, France, etc.
Right.
Okay. So that's something something new. Okay. So you do have campaign corporate campaign contributions to political parties and politicians in England.
Well, that's the thing, that the New Labour was being sustained for a long time more by its corporate contributions than from its traditional source of finance, which was the trade unions.
Mm-hmm.
The trade unions, you see, the tragedy is that the Labour Party now is relying on the donations of trade unions, and it's not delivering the goods as far as the programme of the trade unions. It's not delivering the goods for the workers.
Mm-hmm.
It's no longer... Again, if you could say, the Labour Party is no longer now dependent on corporate finance, but on the finances of the trade unions, but it's not delivering the goods. So therefore, that creates tremendous strains on the loyalty of trade unionists.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's why there is a debate going on within the British trade union movement as to whether or not it is time to start afresh and to look for a new party. Now, I have to say, that hasn't gone very far. And what is rather surprising, if you like, it's like the story of the dog that didn't bark in the night. It seems very strange that there has been no real movement of workers in Britain, and I think this also applies for other countries, but no real movement either to reclaim the Labour Party as a workers' party, nor to replace it by a new party. And I think that is connected with the changed physiognomy of the working class worldwide. If you like, as I said before, you know, given those figures, that now the real epicenter and the heavy battalions of the working class are no longer to be found in Britain, Western Europe, and North America. They're to be found, a virgin proletariat, if you like, is beginning to take root in entirely new territories.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We got another host here on the show, Damian Matthew. He's a graduate union person at the University of Illinois, and he has a question from a caller that just called in.
Oh, so a caller was asking, what's the difference between parliamentary labor and constituency labor? And I wonder if you have some comments about that.
Well, that's a good question. It used to be There used to be a thriving constituency base for the Labour Party. I mean, the Labour Party was a little, was always like a, sort of in the areas, was like a little parliament for the trade unions and for various left and socialist organisations. But I'm afraid that constituency life in most of Britain has completely dried up. So that's why there's a real crisis for the Labour Party. It's going to lose its parliamentary base at the next election. It'll be reduced maybe to 50, between 50 and 100 MPs out of 600 odd. That seems to be on the cards. And at the moment, there is no real life, no organic movement of people at the base.
I wonder if I could break in here for a second. Dave, this is John.
Okay, hi, John. This is John Ryman from Oakland. Yes, come on. Okay, John.
Well, Roger, you started to talk a little bit about the change in the composition of the working class in countries like Britain and the United States and the decline in the industrial proletariat. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the historical role of that sector of the class and just amplify on that question a little bit, as well as the rise of that same sector of the class and country in other parts of the world.
You're asking about the role of the working class in these new territories?
The industrial working class. And also, you talked a little bit about the decline in the industrial working class in countries like Britain and the U.S. How much do you see that as being related to the decline, the change in the Labour Party and that sort of thing?
Well, I heard a most absolutely astounding figure. In 2007, this was announced on the morning radio as I was getting up, and it really woke me up with a jolt, that the number of manufacturing workers in Britain had dipped below the level that it was in 1848. Not 1948, 1848. In other words, the manufacturing base of Britain has declined to pre-industrial levels. And I think a similar figure is, could be seen even in the USA. For instance, I saw some figures as well. This is by no means a complete story. But within 5 years alone, between 1998 and 2003, that 3 million jobs were lost in America in manufacturing. And I think that explains a lot of these strange political developments, that the fact that there's been so muted a response to the crisis, I'm talking relatively speaking, of course, there has been a response. In fact, there's been a beginning of a wave of occupations and sit-ins in Britain, as well as in France and some of the other countries in Europe. But generally speaking, it's muted compared to the extent of the crisis. So we're in a crisis which is as serious as the 1930s, and we have many years of continuation of that crisis to come, I'm afraid. And we are not seeing yet the kind of response that you might have expected. And I think it's partly because of this fact that the working class, which the traditional base has always been in a small number of countries, and I think now we're getting a virgin proletariat developing, which is really, really beginning to learn the lessons all over again that were learned 100 or 150 years ago. In the more traditional bases of the working class. For instance, I heard a figure recently that in China, I think there were 40,000 strikes last year. There are more strikes in China than in any other country in the world. And we're seeing in China, in some of the countries of Africa, in Latin America, of course, the whole of the subcontinent. We're seeing in Southeast Asia, too, we're seeing strikes, general strikes, huge battles. For instance, very recently, almost pitched battles, almost literally armed pitched battles between sit-in strikers in South Korea and organized paramilitary forces to dislodge them. This is the kind of thing. We're going to see real global struggles at the beginning of, for the first time, a real global working class in the truest possible sense of the term. You know, if you look at the old international organs of the working class, they were based in Britain, in Western Europe, and in North America, the time of the Second International. But you know, the next international will be truly global in its proportions. It'll be based on every continent. It'll be representing men and women in their, not only in their tens of millions, their hundreds of millions, but their thousands of millions, their billions, and would, you know, could create an enormous force. All it needs is the lessons of history to be, you know, will have to be percolated again into these new territories.
Okay, Roger, we've got a few more minutes left here, and I'd like to finally ask you, and also don't let me forget, you've recently put a position paper online and also are working on a book, and I want to mention that to get people to they can access that. But first I want to ask you, what are your impressions of the United States, both from what you see on the news in Britain, as well as your time spent here recently, just right now, in fact?
Well, it's always, It's a mind-blowing experience to visit the United States and to see it. I have to say, compared to some of the countries I've spent time in, like India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, the Philippines, and so on, of course, living standards are still a bit better in USA than they are there. I did spend yesterday, for instance, sailing on a yacht in the bay, in a yacht owned by a retired carpenter, which wouldn't happen in a number of countries. So I have to say, I'm not really making a very serious point here. But of course, there is still, you know, there's enormous wealth still accumulated in America. But I know there's another side of that. I know that there's growing poverty. I know there's growing unemployment. I see. Even this morning, in this morning's paper, I see another big bank has collapsed. We see there is a real crisis in the U.S. economy. Who could have possibly believed for a moment that we would see nationalization of the biggest banks in the world, and not even by Obama, but by Bush, before he was finally left power? We can see when things like that are happening, then there's a real crisis. And we will see, I'm sure, within, because there are fantastic rich militant traditions in the American working class. We will see a return to those traditions. We will see a return to the traditions of the 1930s, of the CIO, of the sit-in strikes, etc., and a return to the radicalism we saw, that I remember, in the 1960s, of the Civil Rights Campaign, the anti-Vietnam War movement, the movement of the black people for freedom, and so on. And I'm sure all of those traditions are still there, buried within the American psychology. And I think with the shocks that are coming, we're going to see an outpouring of all that is best and finest in American culture.
Well, let's hope so. So finally, you have an online position paper, and also you're working on a new book. Can you leave our listeners with, first of all, a little bit about this and where they can find access to this?
Right. Well, I want to put it very modestly. I mean, I, together with a group of friends in Britain and in America and in France and other countries, in Pakistan, we got together, we produced a sort of statement of our position on what is happening in the world today. We've given it, you might think, a rather grandiose title, Preparing for Revolution. But I think what we mean by that is preparing for the kind of life and death struggles that are coming, which can only be resolved either by a complete revolutionary change in the whole way society is run, or in some terrible defeats. And that preparing for revolution, we call ourselves the Workers International Network. We're not at all, we are not like all these self-appointed messianic little groups with pretensions to say that we are the world party of the future, or we're the embryo of the future international. We're just a group of comrades who tried to put a few ideas together in order to help to stimulate a proper discussion. We have an online discussion group, and we put that there, but you can find the document Preparing for Revolution. If you want to write, are you still there?
Yes, I'm. Mm-hmm.
Oh, sorry. We've got an email address, which is contact@workersinternational.net. And we would like to, we really value the opinions and the ideas of anybody. Oh, so I've got a website address, worldwide-socialist.net.
Okay.
Okay, well, very good. Roger, thank you so much for calling in. And
Can I ask one last question?
Of course.
Roger is also involved in the publication of a student magazine. Maybe he'd like to make one comment about that.
Have you got time, David?
Yes, of course.
Well, I would love to make a plug for that. As you know, I did say that I'm working now as a teacher of English in a school in London. The thing I'm proudest of having done is that we produced, I helped the students there to produce a magazine which we call Carbolic. And I think it's an absolutely unique, although I say it myself, it's a unique publication. It's poetry, stories, ideas, articles, reports, and so on, from these young teenage students, as I say, from all ethnic backgrounds. It's been praised by world famous writers like Benjamin Zephaniah, Michael Rosen, John Agard, and so on. Benjamin Zephaniah said he's seen student magazines all over the world, and this is the best he's ever seen. I make no apology because it's nothing. I'm not really promoting myself in this, but the incredible talents and enthusiasm of the kids who really produce this. They entered into a competition for a poetry slam in 2005, and they actually won with a sort of rap poetry performance. And their prize was to visit somewhere very near you, David. They visited Chicago in 2005 and performed some of the schools in Chicago. But also, apart from publishing the magazine, Carbolic has held meetings on the school premises, completely independent of the school authorities. But we invited, for instance, Wasambeg, who had only recently been released from Guantanamo detention camp, and he came and told the students about his experiences there. We had another speaker from a campaign over the racist murder in prison of a teenager, who his family campaigned for justice. We had meetings about in protest against the invasion of Gaza, which we had Jewish and Muslim speakers speaking in solidarity. And we even had our friend John Ryman here from Oakland, who, on a visit to England, who came over and spoke to the students about the election of Obama, which was something which created great hope and enthusiasm among our students. And, that's something I feel really happy about, because I think it gives a kind of testament to the kind of talent, to the kind of aspirations for change that there are among the young people, not only in London, but throughout the world.
Is there a way to access some of Carbolic's material and information online?
I have to say that we're in the process of constructing a website, and it's still not properly off the ground, I'm afraid. But
okay.
I will find a way to get news, if you can, in a future program of yours, if you could broadcast the website address. I would love to have some kind of dialogue with some of your listeners.
Oh, absolutely. We'd be honored to. Okay, Roger and John, thank you so much for calling in. And Roger, enjoy the rest of your time here in the United States, and maybe we'll have you on the show again sometime.
Thank you, David. It's been a real pleasure talking to you all.
Likewise. Take care.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye.